interviewing Doug MacArthur, who's the most beloved of all the members of Trinity Episcopal Church in Solbury. And he's my first interview, and we've had a mishap in the beginning with recording equipment. And so let's hope we're off to a better start, because poor Doug has to repeat most of what he said for an hour. So I'm going to start off, Doug, by asking you about your grandfather again and what his occupation was and where he did his job.
My grandfather on my mother's side was a farmer in a place 14 or 15 miles south of Edinburgh, near a town called Roslyn. In fact, his farm was called Lang Hill, and it reached down to the foot of his farm, reached into Roslyn Glen. And in Roslyn Glen is a famous chapel called Roslyn Chapel, which recently got its fame from the Da Vinci Code, because it's mentioned in the end of the Da Vinci Code. There was a search for the Holy Grail, and one of the places they thought it might be hidden was in the basement of this little church. The church has in it a column called the Apprentice Column, and it seemed like this apprentice carved this column with all kinds of different religious symbols in it, and the symbols of not just Christian symbols, but also Muslim and Jewish symbols. And that's what attracted Brown, the writer of the Da Vinci Code. And it's in the movie, too. But anyway, Roslyn Chapel is owned by a Lord St. Clair. And Lord St. Clair is of modest means. As a matter of fact, he's a bobby in London. He's a policeman. That's his sole sort of income. And a little gift shop at Roslyn Chapel, although now it may be a little busier than it used to be. Also interesting in my grandfather's farm is that when he sold that farm to the local government center, like a county center, and that's where Dolly was cloned. On my grandfather's farm, because there's a picture in Life magazine that my daughter sent me that shows my grandfather's farmhouse interposed with Dolly in the background. And that was my grandfather on my mother's side. I want to add that his father was also interesting, and he had been a friend of Bobby Burns. And I didn't realize this till one of my cousins showed me an article of where he had been asked, my great-grandfather had been asked to speak at Bobby Burns' funeral about his youth, about Bobby Burns' youth. That was, so you can see that Scotland's just a small little niche of a country. All the people in the Highlands of Scotland are less than half the population of Bucks County. Did you know that?
Really, I didn't.
The whole part of,
oh my goodness,
of the Highlands.
What an influence they had on the world.
But on my father's side, MacArthur, my dad was one of four, and he thought that the business couldn't, my great-grandfather was a painter in Edinburgh, house decorating and house painting, and his father had started a business, my great-grandfather, MacArthur. He had helped decorate Balmoral Castle when Queen Victoria was taking it over. So I have these little fringe touches with royalty, but it's way out in the fringes. And so Dad came over just before World War I, and although he had been going with Mother in Edinburgh, they were, but my mother's parents thought that she was too young to be going out with such a man of ill repute, I guess. They were from high society in Leech, which is hard to believe it. It was possible to have any high society. That's just a pork camp. But anyway, my father was on the west side and mother was on the east side. But my dad pretended to take out my mother's older sister, janitor. And my mother would tag along just as a sort of a almost like a pain in the neck. My older sister knew what was going on, and she was completely supported my father, the whole deal. But anyway, they made a pact. I still have a writing they made. My dad left for the United States. My mother made a pact that she would come over within 2.5 years, regardless of what the parents thought, to get married. And Dad came and left around March of 1914, before World War I, and did very well over here. And Mother came over during the war in a convoy because of the submarine scare. And they met and were married in New York City. Mother had an older brother who was already a successful accountant in New York City. So that kind of influenced my dad to make me go study accounting. She was doing very well. So what did we go into next? We discussed the...
Okay, and then I asked you where you spent your formative years, 4 through 12. But you started...
I got earlier. But when I was about 2, no, maybe I was about 3, Mother and Dad wanted to go back and show me off to the grandparents. So Mother, but they couldn't all afford to go. So Mother and I went on one ship, and I think Dad had to stay home and work, stay in this country and work. But on the way over, Mother broke her ankle on board ship, and they did a bad job of repairing it, so that when she got to Scotland, instead of her traveling around seeing all the relatives, she was laid up. So I had to spend at least a year or more in Scotland while Mother recovered and was able to come back to the States. So I got a pretty good dose of Scotland back when I was about 3 and 4. I remember coming back from Scotland on board a ship, a small ship, that almost ran out of food coming over. And because this was in March, the middle of winter.
Oh, yeah.
I remember, one of the first things I remember as a child is being in Halifax, where they stopped in Halifax to get some food, and looking out and seeing all the ships covered with icicles.
Oh,
all the spars of ships and everything. That's one of the vaguest early memories I have of, I can visualize. Anyway, we got back to this country, and Dad had us in a place in Powhatan Avenue in Philadelphia, which was a low rent district, but it was where eventually the African, Mayor Wilson.
Oh,
Bombarded
yes.
These African.
It was Move.
Was move, it the Move?
It was some the Move something, or I can't recall.
Move group, yeah.
Yes.
That was on Powhatan Avenue. It was right where I lived for about a couple of years, and then we moved over to Collingswood, or Fairview, and then Collingswood, New Jersey, and that's where I spent the rest of my formative years, you might say, grammar school, junior high, and high school. And my mother and father were still lived there when I went to Penn And they were still living there, I guess, at the time I got drafted. And just about the end of the war, they bought the property up in Solbury. But we had been coming up to Solbury almost every summer when I wasn't going over to England or Scotland or some other place. I would be coming to Solbury and spending my time with my friend named Tom Bagg, who was Ann Bauer's son. And we lived on the, we spent our summers on the farm where the Bucks County Audubon Society is now located. And I had various jobs like baling hay and shucking corn, whatever.
Tell me about the general store that you talked about that was
at Solbury, which is now the post office. Used to be a general store that sold almost everything. Shoes, I remember one little section where the mailboxes are now was a shoe store, shoe portion. But there was groceries and out front were these upright pumps, circular pumps with these big glass tanks on the top where you would work a pump to put the gas up into these 5 or 6 gallon jugs of glass and then feed it into your car by gravity, by hose later on. That was a real general store. When they say general, it was everything in that store. It was not only food, but also grains and seeds and even some small farm equipment. Thinking back, I don't see how they had room for all the things that they had in there. Right. That was the general store.
What was your first adventure on your own?
Well, I guess that the first one of any interest would be this trip to Europe in 33 as a Boy Scout. I'd been pretty active in the Scouts in Collingswood, and then this was about the third World Jamboree. It was in Gerdala, Hungary, and I had it. My dad thought I would be interesting, and I was happy to go along with him on that. And he somehow wanted to get rid of me every summer, send me off someplace. So I thought I'd go to Europe, and I was quite anxious to go. And the troop I was with, there were about 4 American troops that were at this jamboree, and the troop I was with was formed in North Jersey, although it had people from all up and down the East Coast. And we first went to a camp and up on the Raritan River and got to know each other. And then we gathered and went across on the Berengaria, SS Berengaria, with, I remember Douglas Fairbanks Jr. was on board.
Oh,
and the interesting thing I think is that this trip, which took the boys from Philadelphia or New York by ship to England to Scotland. I went to Scotland, but the rest of the kids were down in London. But it took them all over London, and then across the Channel to Belgium. Then up the Rhine, through Germany, into Austria, Vienna, and then over to Budapest, where we camped for about 2 or 3 weeks, back through Austria, back through Switzerland, toured all parts of Switzerland, into France, Paris, to Cherbourg, and then on the Aquitania, back to the States. And the whole thing, I think, cost about $250. It's just amazing.
Amazing. What an adventure.
And I remember I was had one, I think one interesting part about this trip in Germany was just, this was right after the Nazis had taken over. And of course they were trying to brainwash us with all kinds of propaganda about how terrible the Jews were. And my buddy through all through Germany was a boy from Brooklyn, New York, Kasper Mershon, Jewish boy. And they were really making him feel like the devil. At least that's what he said, and I could see why. But then we, when we went into Hungary, I got one interesting assignment. I was on an honor guard for the regent of Hungary, who was sort of like the president of Hungary. Here's a landlocked country, and the regent, or the president, or dictator, whatever it was a man named Admiral Horthy. He was an admiral in the old ancient Austrian-Hungarian navy. But Hungary itself never had a navy, or if it did, it was only a bunch of boats up and down the Danube. But the other interesting thing was a trip through the Nazi headquarters in Munich, the Brown House. Hitler was going to take us around, but he was out of town. So Rudolf Hess showed us around this quarters, and they were being very friendly, and you know, trying to impress us with all their bon vivant and all that nonsense. But underneath, they were all the streets were covered with swastikas. Every telephone pole, every shop window had a swastika, and it was surprised me when I eventually got home to this country. I saw the same thing.
Really?
It struck me as the same thing. It was the Blue Eagle. But while I was over in Europe, the National Recovery Act, the NCA started, and the symbol for that they were trying to impress everybody what a wonderful thing this was the Blue Eagle. And they had this Blue Eagle on every telephone pole and in every store window in the country. And it reminded me of all the swastikas.
Oh my goodness.
And of course, I didn't realize fully how serious this German thing was. We did have at one town, where was that? Koblenz. We were on a train going down into Austria, and a young boy, tried to come and buy one of our uniforms so he could escape. It was a young Jewish boy.
Oh,
and he was trying to get out of Germany way back in 1933.
Wow.
So that even then, and I'm not sure about my dates, whether Kristallnacht had happened then or not.
Yes,
but it was, obviously the pressure was on, and all the bad times were really starting.
Tell about the Baron von whatever.
I don't have his name in here. Anyway, this charming German, blonde German guy, he looked like a film star, became our guide as we entered into Germany from Belgium. And right there at Cologne, and he took us under his wing, you might say, and he was a most charming guy. One other point I should point out: when we went through Germany, our normal scout uniform for the trip for the jamboree was a red neckerchief, but because they were so anti-communist through Germany, we had to take special neckerchiefs. And we had to wear blue neckerchiefs through Germany. Just because they couldn't handle the thought, though, you know, the swastika was on a red ball. There was a black swastika on a red, a red ball, but we couldn't wear red neckerchiefs in Germany. But anyway, so, you know, we adhered to what they wanted. It didn't make that much difference to us. But this guide who took us all through Germany and then remained friendly with our scoutmaster, after our trip and we were back in the United States, first thing you know, he came over and renewed his friendship with our scoutmaster, and they were living and enjoying each other's company, and so he was apparently over here on business or something, except that when Pearl Harbor came, the FBI came down and picked him up immediately and put him in jail, because it was turned out that he was in charge of espionage in the United States for Germany. He was just setting things up. We were completely innocent about the whole thing. We didn't know what was going on.
And you were 14.
Yeah.
And being influenced by
trying to,
the head of espionage.
But when they were trying to preach to us about how they claimed they lost the war because of the Jews, and they had won the Battle of Jutland, which that I really objected to because of being a Scottish and British background. I knew all my life that the British had won the Battle of Jutland, even though they lost a few more ships. But they still drove the German fleet back into the Baltic Sea. Wouldn't let them get out into the North Sea. But that's not what they would tell us in Germany.
Of course not.
Anyway, so that's what this diary is all about.
And this diary is just marvelous. That's something that your family should keep forever.
Has all these interlocking
all these amazing places, and the fact that you've kept it all these years. And
yeah, I was trying to find out if I did have the name of that baron, but I can't. This is a whole year of stuff, like going to school, coming back. But then through August and June, July and August, it's all my trips. The trouble with me when writing this, I do the same thing year after. Got up early, breakfast, got up early, breakfast. And then I went to bed.
Well, it gets you started writing anyway on the on the adventure. Okay, what was your first job, and what was your salary? And what did you learn from that experience?
The first job, I was just cutting lawns and that sort of thing. If I got 50 cents for cutting a lawn, I considered myself lucky. I also started when I was in high school, a company, a friend of mine and I were washing windows. And we called our company the Admit More Sunlight Window Washer Company.
I love that.
That lasted for a few months. Made a few dollars, but not much. And then when I went, I used to come up here, up to Solbury in the summers, and would help out on the farms around in Solbury. But I can't remember any idea how much I was paid then. I guess the first paying job as a regular employee might have been when I was first year in. Right after high school, when I was just graduating from high school in 36, I had a job painting houses and all around Collingswood. And I cannot recall what I was paid. Next year, I had a job as a lifesaver in Surf City. In 38, I was a lifeguard. This 37, I went abroad. 38, I was a lifeguard in Surf City, and I made more money on my day off clam digging. I would clam dig right in the bay. Now it's all, you know, it's gone through pollution and that sort of stuff. You can't do it anymore. But I used to get a rubber an inner tube with a big bushel basket in it, and I would bring up the clams with my feet, put them in this basket, load it up, and take it ashore and sell them to New York restaurateurs for a penny a piece.
Oh my.
And I was making more money selling clams at a penny a piece than I was lifeguarding. So I remember the next year, that was in 39, I really went for, I needed to make go for some money. So I went, I got a job as a milkman in Atlantic City, and I had the red light district of Atlantic City, right at the poor section, right in the center, because the regular milkman would take the suburbs, the Ventnor, and further on south, because that's where the bigger money was. But they let this little college kid have the red light district. And I became an expert in directing people to the places of ill repute, because they were my customers.
And they drank milk.
Yeah, they were. And I remember that I would have to wake people up when I delivered the milk. And that was back in the days, I would be getting up at 3:30 every morning. I'd be at work at 4:30, and I would bang on the door as I delivered the milk, because if I didn't, it would be stolen.
Oh,
people didn't come and pick it up.
Oh my goodness.
It would be stolen. This was, you know, 39, we were still in the Depression. And I used to work, as I say, at least I'd work from 4:30 to 7 in the evening.
Oh.
Every day. Monday through Sunday. 7 days a week. Because I could get money for every empty bottle that I brought home back to the shop. I was doing all right till the end. I was delivering milk to a numbers racket place, which apparently they allowed, although it was illegal, they were allowed numbers writing and everything, and there was these places, bars and places where they had all this. And I was delivering, and I had my car parked on the left side of the road. And a truck pulled in behind me and then pulled out before I delivered and caught the rear end of my truck and tore off the rear end of it. It was an old electric truck, tore off the end of it and then sped away. I never did catch it. And I had to go back. I finished my route. I went back with this wreck of a back of the truck. And I went into the place as I delivered the milk and delivered, you know, all this stuff and signed in for the day or something. And then I said, "Would you fix that truck up for tomorrow?" And it was an absolute wreck. And the manager was ready to fire me on the spot because they were in the middle of a safety drive. And here I had parked on the left-hand side of the road and got in an accident. And they just blew all his chances for some safety prize he was never going to get.
Oh, dear.
But I was too near the end of the season, so he gave me a gasoline-driven truck for the rest of the couple of weeks I was in. He was so upset.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But
it so kept was, you in school. Yeah. You didn't want to do that for the rest of your life.
That was 39. And I knew the world was changing then, because as I left to go home, the paper said that Hitler had invaded, or the Germans had invaded Poland in the beginning of March, the beginning of September 39. So that, so then I, after school, during school I worked too, because I, in order to pay for my room and food at the fraternity, I washed dishes and I kept the books.
Oh, really?
Yeah. kept the accounts, and I don't know, that paid for my meals or something. But then after graduating, getting ready to graduate from Penn, I'm looking for a job. I wanted to get a job in public accounting, and even though my uncle was one of the partners in a New York firm which had a Philadelphia office, he wouldn't hire me. So I, till the busy season started. So I had to find another job, and I got a job at a bank in Philadelphia. And so I had all kinds of different jobs.
And you were in the military.
Yeah.
And was that between Wharton and Penn, or was that...
No, I graduated from Penn, 1940, and June of 40, and I got two of my fraternity brothers and I had an apartment in Philadelphia, and two of us were drafted on the same day in March of 41, which is 9 months before Pearl Harbor. So we were drafted very early in the game. And we both, he was originally from Boston, so he went up to Boston to be inducted, and I was inducted right in Philadelphia. And I was sent to basic training down at Camp Croft, South Carolina, which is outside of Spartanburg. And there I, after, what do you call it, I guess the first 90 days or so, we were all being supposed to be shipped back to Pennsylvania, to Indiantown Gap. But at the time, I was getting a magnificent sum of $18.75 a month as my pay as a private. And I was offered to be a trainer down at Camp Croft, to stay at Camp Croft. I was offered the job of being a corporal, which meant that I would be getting $32 a month.
Ooh, wow.
So this was a tremendous increase. So I said, okay, I'm not going back to Philadelphia or Pennsylvania. I'll stay down in South Carolina if I have to be in the service. And originally we were supposed to be drafted for 1 year. And then when I was down there that year, I guess that summer of 41, by one vote, Congress extended the draft 3 years.
Oh, boy.
By one vote. And I said, my God, if I'm going to have to be in for 3 years instead of 1 year, I might as well try to get a commission. So I applied for Officers Candidate School, and I got I got in about the third class with Nelson Rockefeller. Not Nelson. Winthrop Rockefeller was in my class.
Really?
My class at OCS. He looked like a soldier when he came in, because he had a big Kaiser handlebar mustache on his face, and at OCS they made him shave it off.
Oh.
But the Yeah, that, so that got me down to Georgia. I kept getting, going further and further south.
So were you in Georgia when...
I was in Georgia when Pearl Harbor
Pearl Harbor.
Mm. Matter of fact, I remember when Roosevelt gave his talk about declaring war, you know, about mm-hmm. what happened. Matter of fact, I was that weekend of Pearl Harbor, I was at a girls' college. We had the weekend off, you know, and one of the fellas had a friend who was the athletic director. His girlfriend was the athletic director of this Montevallo College, which is down near Birmingham, Alabama. You're not too far from Camp Croft, or Camp Fort Benning. You're not too far from Fort Benning. So we drove. One of the other fellows had a car, so three of us drove over to this college, and I have my picture taken, walking with one of the girls. Two of us have our picture taken. It became the front copy of their yearbook, because it was just the weekend of Pearl Harbor.
Oh,
so I was with girls at college girls at Pearl Harbor instead of being at Pearl Harbor. Anyway,
that's good.
Yeah, matter of fact, that's another story.
Oh, good.
Pearl Harbor. When I was in high school, I thought I would save my dad cost of my college tuition if I could go to West Point or Annapolis. So I applied for Annapolis. I was always winning. I came in second. And the guy who beat me out was a man who had graduated a year ahead of me from Collingswood High School, and he was killed at Pearl Harbor.
Doug! Oh!
If I had won, I might have been in
You might have been there.
Crazy?
My goodness.
Herb Conmigger. Yeah.
That brings you up short, doesn't it, when you think of something.
So anyway, that's... let's see.
Oh, I got.
Well, Camp Croft, and then down to Fort Benning. And on the Pearl Harbor day, or the day that Roosevelt declared war, we were in Georgia digging foxholes in training, digging foxholes, climbing into the foxholes, and allowing tanks to drive over us.
Oh, my goodness.
They were training us to dig foxholes. And so we got, one of the other strange things about our officers' candidate school in infantry, every person in our company had to be voted on in order of their popularity, or, you know, what we all thought of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they automatically eliminated the lowest 5%. Sent them back to their units.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So they I thought that was so rough and mean and, you know, mentally shocking. But that's what they did.
Hmm.
They just eliminated the lowest 5% as far as the rating goes. And Winthrop Rockefeller was there, and he was a good soldier. He was very popular. They kept him on as an instructor there for a while. And I had this two buddies that we went over to Montevallo, and we were all sent to Fort McClellan next to help start training draftees ourselves before we formed the cadre of other divisions. I was... One fella, Les Patrick, was sent to Fort Huachuca in Arizona. Yeah. In Fort Huachuca, New Mexico, or Arizona? No, Arizona. It's right next to below Tucson, so that would be Arizona. Where he was made and put in charge of black troops. and ended up in Bougainville, in the Pacific. Bougainville.
I'm not familiar with that.
That's one of the islands near Guadalcanal.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow.
And then I was sent as a cadre for a division called the 85th Division that eventually fought in Italy. My third buddy, Julius Phillips, was sent to Bermuda.
Oh, my.
He spent most of the war in Bermuda.
In Bermuda, how nice. And you were in Italy.
My division was. I had an old football injury. It came out while I was at Camp Shelby, Mississippi, where the division was forming, and I thought the Army should fix it. They thought differently, and they stuck me in camp headquarters, and my division went overseas. Every officer was either wounded or killed at Mount Cassino.
Oh, yes, Monte Cassino.
Monte Cassino. They fought at Monte Cassino, and then they went into the southern landing in France. You know, that's what the 85th did. But I had this old football injury, and it might have saved my life.
Sounds like twice your life was saved. Yes. Now, you told me earlier that you were in the infantry. And what rank did you end up with as an officer?
I ended up as a major.
As a major.
I was a sort of a training officer. When they stuck me at Camp Headquarters, they had me in all kinds of jobs. I was orientation officer, I was athletic officer, and finally they made me training officer. So I helped train, or helped get things ready to help train the 442nd Division. The 442nd Regiment, not Division, Regiment, was the Japanese-American Division, a regiment, that fought in Italy, collected more medals and honors than any other regiment in the history of America.
Oh, my goodness.
And the reason they did it is because they had to prove that they were loyal American citizens, mm-hmm. and they were driven to prove themselves more than any other normal American. That was one of the most interesting assignments, watching that division or regiment get ready. The other interesting assignment I had is I had to train soldiers of the opposite extreme, soldiers of doubtful loyalty.
Really?
Yeah. I had, when they had a battalion of soldiers of doubtful loyalty. They had a company of Germans of German descent, a company of Italian descent, company of Japanese descent, and a company of Irish descent.
Irish!
And these four companies, what the government was trying to figure out, are these people really disloyal, or are they just trying to get out of going overseas? So they would be invested, the FBI would be investigating their background, and they'd decide, okay, this group of maybe 20 or 30 of them, they're just faking. They just want to go overseas. Don't want to go overseas. So now you get them ready to go overseas. And normally they try to train you in about three months, you know, before you're prepared. I had to get these guys ready in about 3 weeks. So I had to give them all these films and all these different fire experiences and stuff, take them through courses, you know, under barbed wire and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things was that we would put some of them out in foxholes with targets that they would hold up, while the others would be firing at these targets. Well, normally Americans would hold up pictures of Tojo and Hitler. These guys were holding up pictures of Churchill and Roosevelt as targets.
Really?
Yeah. To try and show.
And they were doing this deliberately to get out of there.
Trying to get out of overseas service.
That's interesting.
I had one case where I took a couple of Japanese boys, refused to come out for bayonet training. So I said, what's the matter with it? I went into the cabin and read the riot act. I said, why are you not coming out? And the boy said to me, well, my father, when Pearl Harbor came, he was from San Francisco. When Pearl Harbor came, a couple of Filipinos came in and decapitated my parents.
Oh!
Into our house.
Oh my.
Filipinos, see, because of what was going on.
Sure.
And you know, I'm not going over there and fight for them. I had to put them in the stockade. There was a book called Snow on the Pines.
Oh, yeah.
Pam Anderson.
Yes. Snow Falling on Cedars.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it was about the mixed feelings and everything of these Japanese Americans.
Yes. I grew up in San Francisco, you know, where and I remember their being put into camps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And seeing the camps when I was a
did
child.
You?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, you'd see them along the road. It seemed so unjust.
Yeah, you know? Well, I remember we put on, in our service center with this Japanese American regiment, we decided to have a dance for them. So we imported Japanese girls from these camps, from these concentration camps. And I almost had a riot on my hands because I didn't have enough girls to take care of all the boys that were in the service club. And we had the service club was crowded, but you know, but there weren't enough girls too to go around and have dance just to dance with them. You know, and we were trying to protect them from each other in a way. But we wanted them to have each, you know, to be with each other.
Oh, dear. Oh, gosh.
And it was fascinating. I stood on the balcony looking down, and there was not a blonde head in the whole group.
No,
everybody was a brunette. Everybody was a brunette.
What a wonderful story.